silent sitting, silent practice, sitting and walking, and then a ritual involving some chanting, and then in this case a talk. So it's interesting how the mind probably has opinions about which of those is good and which of them is more important, you know. And I really don't know. Is it most important to sit quietly? Is it most important to do a ritual together, moving our bodies in harmony, bringing up these teachings as best we can? Is it most important to listen to me? Go on. Who knows? But this is the form that we have. So I thought I would speak, before I speak about the Zen story for tonight, I would speak a little bit about what we just chanted, because for some of us, those were new chants. So for all the years of our existence as a Sangha, we've done another set of chants each week, so we are now going crazy and doing different things, going wild. So the first thing we chanted, Makahanya Haramita Shingyo, and it says right on there on the sheet, so you know it says right on the book what it is. It's the Heart Sutra in Sino-Japanese. So what does Sino-Japanese mean? So the Heart Sutra, maybe you know from other evenings, is a text about emptiness that uses negation in an interesting way. It seems to claim that we don't have eyes, ears, nose, or tongue, or taste, or anything like that. And it also includes a sort of sense of, it proclaims its own sort of magic. When we chant it in English, you can hear how it says, this whole thing is sort of like a mantra. It's like just chanting this has a certain kind of power. And it's great, it's unexcelled, it's perfect, it relieves us all from suffering. And then there's some sort of mysterious Sanskrit words at the end, which are a mantra within the mantra. So this is getting even more mantric, I think, to chant these syllables, because most of us don't know what they mean. And not only do we not know what they mean, a Japanese person hearing this won't know what any of this means either. So therein is the Sino part in Sino-Japanese. Each of those sounds correspond to a character in the Chinese version of this text, Chinese Heart Sutra, and there's a standard translation that almost everybody chants, like maybe everybody, but that's never true, so almost everybody. 266 characters, I think, is the number. The translation was done by an 8th century Chinese pilgrim named Xuanzang, who is the coolest guy, like he's Marco Polo on steroids. He snuck out of China and did a 16-year journey through out the Silk Road, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles through the desert with many adventures and difficulties. And he did this whole tour of Buddhist India at the time because he felt like what they had so far in China was incomplete, you know, and he needed more teachings. He studied at the great Buddhist University of Nalanda, which is supposed to have more than 100,000 scrolls. It's a huge library, bigger than the library. We're so Western, you know, biased, right? It's bigger than the Library of Alexandria. It's a huge library, you know, and was later destroyed, as so many things have been. But anyway, the controversy, I'll now tell you about this terrible controversy. So this is his translation, but it's also possible that he wrote it himself. And claimed it was a translation of an Indian text, which would have been written in Sanskrit. That is actually possible. We don't know. It was a long time ago. But no matter where it came from, it's a very central text in Zen centers everywhere. And one of the cool things about this particular translation, these particular sounds, is these are the sounds that are used when this is translated all over the Japanese Buddhist world, which includes Japanese Buddhism that's gone through Europe and South America and Asia, other parts of Asia. In most of those places, people speak a number of languages and they just chant it like we just chanted it. It's an artifact mostly of a North American Zen to chant it in English. So in other words, you go to a Zen center in France because so many people are there from Germany and all over the place, they probably won't chant a French translation. They'll chant what we just chanted. So this is very universal, which is kind of cool. If you get familiar with this, you can go any number of places and they'll announce this chant and you'll know exactly what to do, even if you're otherwise completely baffled, you know. So I've chanted this in Zurich and in Paris and I think a few other places I'm not thinking of, with people about whom otherwise I didn't share a whole lot of language. But the Sino part, Sino is, of course, is a term for Chinese culture, Sinese. And so the Japanese, when they borrowed the Chinese characters to use for their own language, which many cultures in Asia did, they came up with their own way of saying them. And so these are not how a Chinese person would pronounce the characters that are behind each of these sounds. But then later, as the Japanese continued to evolve their own language and to think about how to write their language down, they came up with a whole other way of pronouncing all these characters. So this is kind of like archaic in Japanese, you know, kind of the old way, you know. They have two different ways of pronouncing each character, this kind of old China-facing way and a modern Japanese way. So that's why a modern Japanese person, and we would get all excited, like, oh, you speak Japanese, you can't, there's a Japanese. And they say, oh, no, I don't understand that at all. So in a way, this is very much a mantra, because these are a voicing of characters which do have meaning. That's why we can translate it into English. It does have meaning. But the actual voicing is not a living language. We're not pronouncing or mispronouncing, as the case may be, anybody's living language. So it's a deep kind of layered, encoded thing. And so even though Zen seems to be sort of rational and logical and involving like stress reduction, and maybe there's a really good thing we'll get called enlightenment maybe one day, that'd be really cool and we'd feel good. It also is sort of magical and mysterious. So it's cool to chant some magical and mysterious things. And this one we know has a meaning behind it, we can look up. And then the second thing that we chanted, we have been chanting, it's a personification of the teachings that the Heart Sutra represents, the perfection of wisdom teachings, the Prajnaparamita teachings. And this is actually a chapter from a much longer text, which is the Prajnaparamita Sutra in how many lines? Lots of lines. 8,000 lines, thank you, Chris. In 8,000 lines is one of the chapters, slightly abbreviated, one of the chapters. And part of why we added that, that actually was an addition, we didn't do that in the very beginning, was we, or I, or somebody, wanted to bring up this personification, especially because it's wonderful that it's a female personification, kind of part of our gradual attempt to sort of balance things out. Because, of course, there have been female practitioners and non-binary practitioners and every kind of practitioner over the ages, and every one of these practitioners are why we can do this today. But the history books were written by the men, as always, and the men are good at leaving out everybody else. So this is actually a traditional text, but it's personified in a female voice. And it also includes some great teachings. Probably the most important teaching in there is the second to last line, where it says, she has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. So that would be worthy of many talks, that line. And so in a way, when we do this chanting, we're throwing all this stuff at you, you know, lots of mud thrown at your internal wall, you know, and some of it will stick little by little, and you'll get to gradually unpack it over a lifetime. But that's a deep teaching about emptiness and a deep teaching about fear. There's a lot that we're frightened by. And the root, according to these teachings, of what we're most frightened by is that we really wish that our life made sense. We really wish that, and that the world made sense. And that things would just kind of stay in place, you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? You get things organized, you get things kind of set, and then your life turns upside down. It happens every 10 times, right? Have you noticed this? And if you don't think that's happening, you're not paying attention, I think, you know. But things are not that way, right? They're fluid. They're not exactly what we think they are. We're not who we think we are. None of it's stable. And all of it is beautiful. It's full of light. She's a source of light because she understands this. And she removes darkness. And this is really excellent. So own being is a technical term for another day. But she's able to face the fluidity of things. The unknowability of things. And she's being able to be with things just as they are. Knowing that we'll never know exactly how things are. We'll only just keep dancing. So that's beautiful. I'm glad we chant that. And then the third thing we chanted was also in mysterious Sino-Japanese voicing. The Shosai Myo Kichijo Dharani. And this is absolutely a mantra. A Dharani is kind of a longer mantra. And here, the origin of this, more or less, we think, and I don't know about this particular text that much, but about Dharanis in general, is that there were a series of sounds that were created in ancient India, some of them predating Buddha, that then were eventually a series of sounds that just felt deeply right, you know, to practitioners as a way to voice this nature of the universe, you know, a way to explore the way things are, just through sound, just through voice. It's like the, what does they say in, what's the Copernican thing about the spheres, the harmony of the spheres, you know?
The music.
Music of the spheres, thank you. Yeah, the music of, so they were the music of the spheres in ancient India, these sounds. And then eventually they're written down in Sanskrit, but mostly not translatable into like sentences. It's like there's words in there, but the words may just be to make that sound, you know? Kind of like if you say blue 1,000 times, eventually it doesn't mean a color anymore, right? It's just a sound, you know? You could try that. It has to be about 1,000, I think, before it really works. It takes a while. Say blue, 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 blue. Even after 10, you know, it starts to lose meaning, right? Or a new meaning emerges, you know? So this one, we're told, is the sounds that prevent disaster. And the idea is that these sounds don't just fill this room. These sounds permeate way beyond this room or multiple universes that somehow intersect in this room or spirit realms or think of it as you may. And like most of us, I grew up, you know, in a scientific family. In fact, my dad is a high-ranking scientist, actually. So it's weird to think about, like, spirits and things we can't understand, but I think little by little, or if we notice, we all have experiences that can't quite be explained by all that either, you know? So I love science, but there's something beyond science, or mixed in with science, or hanging out with science, complementing that way of viewing the world. So these sounds, if we say them with a good heart, do prevent disasters. I think we can have faith in that. There would be more disasters if we didn't chant this, so this is a really good thing to do. But anyway, I didn't finish the story of this text, sorry. So it was written down in Sanskrit, and then the Chinese said, oh my God, how are we going to translate that into Chinese? You know, it doesn't have meaning in that way. So they picked Chinese characters that made the sounds that were kind of like the Sanskrit sounds. And then the Japanese guys used their versions of the sounds for the sounds for the sounds, right? So are they the right sounds? Of course. They're absolutely the right sounds, but they've been through a few translations, you know, or transliterations is the term they use, right? Using a sound to stand for another sound. You know, would the ancient Indians who thought of this recognize us chanting it? Maybe they would. They'd recognize the heart of it, even if they didn't recognize these particular voicings. And the last thing we chanted, and this is kind of unique to the Zen tradition, we chanted a teaching poem. More usual to chant sutras, to chant the words of Buddhas and ancient teachings that, you know, describe this path. But the Zen teachers tried to put the essence of their understanding into poetry. And it's really hard to translate Chinese and English, so it doesn't appear to be a poem, you know, the way it's laid out in the page and the way it sounds. But the original is actually lines of four characters each, bump, 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 bump. But if the translators were to try to literally stick English words that mean those four characters in every line, it would just come out like gibberish. It wouldn't be understandable or chantable. And so they've tried to kind of just focus more on the meaning and then hopefully also make it chantable. But this is a teaching poem from a great ancestor from the 8th century. So actually contemporaneous with Xuanzang, the guy who brought us the Heart Sutra. And he was just in a different, this guy was in a different part of China than Xuanzang, further south. And his name in Chinese is a very confusing one to transliterate. It looks like Shi To, but it's actually Shur To. How would you know? Shur To. And so it's kind of a radical thing that the Zen teachers thought, you know what? The Buddhist teachings are thousands and thousands of volumes. I can do it in 30 lines. And when they nailed it, their students appreciated it so much that they kept reciting that poem, and it got gradually, you know, flowed into our liturgy. But this is a wonderful meditation on the apparent opposites in our life, light and dark, you know. What is light? What is darkness? And all that we map to the ways that we divide things into, you know, big and small, smart and dumb, so on and so forth. And what I love about this text is that it does have certain lines. It's great to study the meaning, and there's a whole books on this. There's a wonderful book of commentaries by Suzuki Roshi on this text, which is wonderful and confusing the way his stuff is. But one of the great things about chanting these in English is some of these lines just get in you. Whether you understand the theme and whether you could write an essay on this at school or not, some of these lines just get in you, and they pop out sometimes when you need them. And for me, the line that pops out sometimes is also towards the end. Well, a couple of them do, but this one is in my mind. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards on your own. Don't set up standards of your own. So this is a big ask, you know. Really understand, you know. And don't think you can be the one who figures that out and is the one that, you know, decides how exactly it should be. So it's like a bit of an antidote to our Americanism, you know, to soften up about how sure we are. You know, we're so sure, you know. It should be this way, it should be that way, you're wrong, I'm right, or if our conditioning the other way, I'm wrong, you're right. Both are the same problem, right? But what if we were to let go of setting up standards of our own and listen more deeply to the meaning of the words that we are offered? What is the real understanding? And one of the ways to do that might be to practice like our teacher in case 12. How'd you like that segue? Of the Mumon Kong. This is a wonderful story, and our dear Dharma sister, Ryushin Andrea Thatch, gave a talk on this in the March Sesshin, so that's on our website somewhere. She's probably more organized about it than I am going to be tonight. And it's the case 12, which is Juiyan calls master. Here's the story, the Zen story. The priest Juiyan, I have trouble with his name, Juiyan, called master to himself every day and then answered himself, yes. Then he would say, be aware. And he would answer, yes. Then he would say, don't be deceived by others. And then he would say to himself, no, no. So this priest, reading the story at the literal level, has a dialogue with himself every day. And a dialogue with others around him. The commentary suggests that he didn't just do this privately, but would walk around saying this kind of stuff. And a lot of his Dharma talks would be already over by now, because he would just say that. And we could practice that way. You could say to yourself when you wake up, probably you don't relate to calling yourself master, but you could use a name, your name. Tim? Yes. Be aware. Yes. Don't be deceived. No. And I bet if you said that every morning, it would change your life. I'm quite certain it would. And it so has obvious applications in going through our days. The first being to show up, right? To remind yourself to show up. We kind of drift along sometimes. Tim?
Yes?
I'm here. Call attendance, you know. And there's only one person in your class. Call attendance. Make sure that one person is paying attention. Because life is ready to serve up a lesson, right? All the time. And the second line makes sense to us. Be aware. So our practice is about awareness. And the wonderful things happen over time. Even without, like, trying to fix our problems. We're just more aware. More knowing of what's happening now as best we can tell. And of course, as the Prajnaparamita teachings were reminding us, we don't really exactly know what's happening now, ever. But it's a lot better to ask the question than to not ask the question. Be aware.
Yes.
I'll be as aware as I can. Maybe better for us than aware, though, is curious. You might say that to yourself. Be curious.
Yes.
Maybe especially you're going into a different situation than you were in a moment ago, which happens how many thousands of times a day? You go from one situation to another situation. You could call the roll. Tim, yes?
Be curious.
Yes. And then go into that meeting, that Dharma hall, that kids' room, that grocery store, that road. This would probably save a lot of lives if when we sat down at the wheel, we did this practice, wouldn't it? Tim?
Yes.
Be aware. Yes. Right? The third exchange is a little more challenging. And it's consistently translated. I looked at several translations because I wasn't so sure about one word in it. It's translated as, don't be deceived by others. And then he says himself, no. But who are these others? Are they voices inside ourself? The other ways that we think we look at ourselves and the things we think we are? Is it others in the conventional sense, like you might fool me if I'm not on my guard? Are you really trustworthy? I think so. So I'm still chewing over this word others. It seems problematic in this text. And in fact, Master Wu Man, who collected these cases into a book, seems also to be a little curious about that. I haven't always been reading you his comments because they're often sort of arcane and weird Zen language. But this one I think is really germane. Woman comments on this story as follows. Old Zhuiyan buys himself and sells himself. He brings forth lots of angel faces and demon masks and plays with them. Why? Look, one kind calls, one kind answers. One kind is aware, and one kind will not be deceived by others. If you cling to understanding this, you're in trouble. If you try to imitate Zhuiyan, your discernment is altogether that of a fox. And foxes in Asia are like tricky and deceitful, and on the face of it, it's not good to be a fox, but Zen also enjoys having a sort of foxy quality to it, you know, with these ways of talking. So one another way to practice with this case, though, is not so much at the grocery store, although we're always everywhere. We can practice this way in Zazen. We could see this also as a Zazen instruction. When you sit down, to remind yourself in a very direct way, I am here. I am sitting now. Which we don't always do, right? You know, we're still thinking about this or that. We're hoping this calms us down a little bit. We're wondering if our neighbor is more cool than we are or something. And we're still worried about what's going to happen at work tomorrow and conflict's got our mind. And I think we all of us have some degree of faith that it'll be beneficial to us to sit and breathe for half an hour. And that the structure of coming here is probably helpful because it's a little embarrassing to leave in the middle. So we tend to stick around, you know, even if it's 30 minutes of fretting, you know. They ring the bell and then you can move. But wouldn't it be good if we sat down with a little more intentionality and called the roll? Tim, are you here? Yes. Be aware. Be curious. Yes. Don't be deceived. Well, maybe we can... Another liberty that Zen and Buddhist teachers take is retranslating things. So until I understand this, the next time I study this book, we'll leave others off. The others are okay. You seem to be the problem, you know? So how about just don't be deceived? Don't be deceived. No. Don't be deceived. So what I have observed is that it's not others I need to worry about so much. The chief deceiver is already here, you know. I'm the one who misunderstands, tries too hard or too little, confuses other people with my sloppy conduct, misunderstands their messages to me and get bent out of shape, you know. I think I might have told you my famous email story. Did I tell you my famous email story before? Yeah, I think I did, so I won't say it again. If I didn't, you can ask me later. And as you can tell, this talk is not really that well mapped out. I'm kind of winging it. Don't be deceived by that. Exactly. Exactly. There's two qualities to Zazen that you can study, though, with the support of this this practice of calling the roll and encouraging yourself to be aware and curious and not to be deceived. And these two qualities, I think, are really important, and I want to recommend that we all practice with these two qualities of in meditation and then in our lives. These are the qualities of... stability and clarity. So I'll end with a few words about stability and clarity. So stability is the ability, or, you know, the ability we gradually develop in practice and in life to hold our awareness on an intended object. So it's not, the awareness is not just flitting around everywhere, whichever way, random thoughts, random this, random worries. But as we sit down and as we take the roll, we set our intention. Maybe your intention is to be aware of the breathing, especially in the belly. That's a very good way to practice, breath awareness practice. And so our intention with stability is that our mind actually stays with the breathing, you know, pretty simple. And then, when our mind wanders off of the breathing, as is not unusual, how can we then practice so that we can continue to develop and enhance and strengthen stability? So, we come back very gently, we come back to our breath awareness in a stable way. We don't beat ourselves up about it, right? Oh, I'm no good at this. That's not necessary, right? That just causes problems. We practice stability, and when we lose stability, we practice stability with losing stability. So little by little, the mind becomes more stable. Doesn't jump around so much. And there's lots of other ways to practice. I'm using breath awareness as a good example. But then clarity is this element of curiosity and awareness. So it's not just that the mind is resting on the breathing and we're sort of spaced out, right? But we're really aware of the subtle feelings of the breathing. And we're aware that we're breathing in a body and we have the sense of clarity and awareness of our body. And we're aware that the body is surrounded by air and sounds and space, and there's a sense of awareness and clarity of the context in which we sit and are aware of our breathing. And so there's a kind of a gradation here between these that we can play with. Sometimes it's helpful to really emphasize stability. Just be here with the breathing. Just in, out, breathing, breathing, breathing. But then sometimes that gets kind of dull, right? And heavy and sleepy. spacey, and there's no clarity, not much clarity, you know. And especially in the beginning, it tends to be a little bit of a battle, I think, or push-pull, I guess. Battle's a little military between stability and clarity. Because sometimes when there's a lot of clarity, we have a great realization, we get so excited, and we're getting better at this meditation thing, it's so cool! And there's no stability, right? We've lost stability. The mind is just spinning, you know, and buzzing. And so then we can come back to stability again. Sometimes the stability on breathing, or wherever you're sort of holding the stability, and the stability can be held so lightly that it doesn't even have an object. It can just be stability without an object. Just a sense of stableness, you know. Non-reactivity, right? Non-stability. And you can open yourself a little more, up more into clarity. What are the dimensions and the subtle feelings? Without needing to make a list or write an essay, but just exploring into being deeply and subtly aware of what is it? What's the deep feeling of being now? Just being. So stability and clarity. And some of us have the great opportunity this next week to practice day and night for 7.5 days. And well, we all have that opportunity, no matter where we are next week. It's just when we go to the Zazen, there's a little more structure, or a lot more. So I thought this might be a good thing to really focus on. When is it helpful to emphasize stability? But when is the stability getting heavy and you're losing clarity? When is it more helpful to open into clarity, curiosity, awareness? Wow. But when does that wow get a little elevated and we lose stability? Like, wow. See what I mean? There's kind of a balance there. And what you're doing this next week, I think it'd be helpful to play with a self-talk that instead of trying to keep you in line in a sort of self-critical way, it's a self-talk that supports this stability and clarity and not fooling ourselves. And I'll read more commentaries and get back to you on this other's word because it's bothering me. And, when we read these old teachings, it's not like they are ipso facto perfect either. These are human beings trying to express the Dharma. So maybe Master Zhuiyan shouldn't have said that word. I don't know. But it would be arrogance to assume that it's wrong too. So I'll stay curious about that. Thank you for listening to my somewhat rambly talk about case 12 and the text that we chant here. I appreciate your attention in letting me practice giving a talk. And my intention is to be a little more prepared, so please excuse me for not making enough time to prepare today.
May our intentions equally